Hello, and welcome to Master My Garden podcast, the podcast that helps you master your own garden, with useful tips, advice and know-how as you go on the way and journey of mastering your own garden. I'm your host, John Jones, and it's a pleasure to be with you here today. So let's get stuck in to this week's episode. How's it going, everybody? Welcome to episode number 19 of Master My Garden podcast. Now, this week's podcast is a new feature that I'm adding into the podcast. It's where I interview somebody from an open garden. And I suppose the idea behind that is that open gardens for many gardeners are a source of inspiration. They can see planting schemes or specific plants or different designs or features that they would like to bring back to their own garden. So generally when somebody visits these, they pick up some form of an idea or some form of inspiration that they can bring back to their own garden. So because of that, I think it's a very good feature to add in. And this week's one is with Mary Keenan from Gash Gardens. Now, up until a couple of weeks ago, I hadn't heard of Gash Gardens, but they're actually based in Castletown in County Laois, which is the same county that I live in, but I had never heard of them. And it's a great interview with Mary. She really describes the gardens extremely well. There's a great story behind the history of the gardens, and it's somewhere that I'm definitely looking forward to getting over to over the next couple of weeks. So that's the basis of the idea of this new type of episode. I hope you like it. So let's get stuck in to this week's episode. So Mary, you're very welcome to episode number 19 of Master My Garden podcast. It's the first of this type of an episode where we're talking about open gardens, and I'm proud to say that Gash Gardens is in my own county, but I didn't actually know it existed until recently. So really looking forward to this chat and looking forward to hearing about Gash Gardens, and hopefully as travel restrictions get lifted over the next couple of weeks, I'll be able to get over and actually see the gardens, which are not that far away from where I live. So maybe by way of an introduction, anyway, as I say, you're very welcome, firstly.
Great. Well, John, thank you very much for that. I'm delighted to be your first open garden to be interviewed, and hopefully you'll have many more to follow.
Yeah, I think, well, it's a feature that I'm trying to add in because obviously open gardens give people who are trying to, I suppose, establish or master their own gardens, it gives them inspiration. And, you know, to be able to go to open gardens and see different ideas and then try and translate them even in a smaller scale back into their own gardens, I think is good. So it's a feature, as I say, I'm going to add in over the next few weeks.
Well, I think that's one of the things that particularly appeals to people who visit our garden. Like, it's relatively new garden, it's just over 35 years in the making. That might seem a lifetime to some people, I know, but you know, maturity can come into a garden quite quickly. It extends over 4 acres, but it evolved from farmland. My late father, really, the story starts with him. He was a dairy farmer, and he always had a huge passion for gardening and an interest in nature. And in the 1970s, he started a small nursery here where we are, near Castletown in Laois, and he propagated and grew his own plants, and eventually evolved into a business, quite a commercial business by the time it reached the mid-80s. But in the mid-80s, he started to develop a garden on 4 acres of what was farmland. When I was a child here, cows were grazing in what is now a garden. And as I said at the outset, for that reason, visitors can quite easily relate to the garden. It's of a scale that you could borrow ideas on the larger scale or the smaller scale, and, you know, interpret and reinterpret them in their own garden. So that's, you know, the underlying appeal, I think, for visitors to come here.
Yeah. And in the 1970s, for somebody in rural Ireland who's coming from a farming background to start a nursery business, which eventually led into an open garden, it wouldn't be a common story, I would guess.
Oh, far from it. But it was to paint a picture of my father. He wouldn't have been one of the most ordinary farmers you would have met either. You know, he had no training in horticulture, no formal education really beyond primary school, but he had a huge energy and great vision, and as I said, a great interest in nature and gardening. He tended not to be deterred by other people's opinions very much, And even, you know, he used to say to us as kids, as a young man, he was one of the first owners in the area of a television, one of the first owners of a tractor. And he'd always be on the outlook, I suppose, for progressive ways of doing things. So even as a dairy farmer, you know, for me as a kid, he had a very unusual dress style. Like, he opted for colourful cravats and brightly coloured waistcoats and pocket watches and tweed caps and jackets. And of course, like every farmer, he had his Wellingtons, but he was quite an unusual sight. But that aside, you know, as I say, he formed an idea that he wanted to create his dream garden, and he went with it. And over the years, you know, some of his fellow farmers in the area would drop in and look at good farmland being turned into a garden. Of course, they'd raise their eyebrows and say, "What's your man at?"
Yeah.
But it didn't deter him. And now, you know, when you see what he left behind, it's a fantastic legacy. It was a great vision he had, and certainly a tribute to his own individuality and his style, that, you know, he went with his gut and created what he felt was right for him to do.
Yeah, absolutely. He stuck to his guns and did something quite unusual. It's great. It's a great story.
You know, as a dairy farmer himself, like, he was quite well respected as well. Like, as a child, when I was growing up in the 70s, he was a master farmer. He provided training to young farm apprentices. And we used to bottle our own milk at one stage, and he had a milk round that, you know, producing milk from the farm, and he delivered it around the local area then himself as well. So, you know, he was quite versatile in the operations that he did over the years. And then, you know, as I said, the nursery started in the 1970s. And, you know, as a child, you know, I spent a lot of my time pricking out seedlings of all sorts of weird, wonderful things in our glasshouse. He started out growing a huge range of summer annuals, far beyond anything that's available nowadays in modern garden centres. And then that expanded into growing shrubs and hedging and so forth in the 80s. And of course, people who are gardening for a long time will know that in the 80s, like, the range of plants compared to what's available nowadays was still relatively limited. And certainly perennial plants were quite a small range, mainly limited to the old cottage garden style. But he began to explore the whole, I suppose, range and availability of perennial plants. And we only ever had a small front garden area towards the front of our house. And he began to collect perennial plants. And of course, the garden was too small, so he needed another area to plant. And that really was partly what sowed the seed to develop the garden, so to speak. But in the 80s, there was a period in England as well where there was quite a number of large garden festivals, mostly on old industrial sites like Liverpool and Glasgow. And in 1984, he went to the Liverpool Garden Festival. It was his first time to travel out of Ireland. And he went with some of his longtime gardening friends and some fellow nurserymen. And I went myself. I was only 15 or 16 at the time. I had just finished my intercert or junior cert, as people call it now.
Yeah.
And I'd done a half-decent exam and got a decent enough result. So as a reward, I went with him. I suppose that'd be most kids' worst nightmare now if they were brought on a gardening trip with their father as a reward.
Nice trip at that time
for the time it was, as such. But we shared an interest, and I suppose mine evolved from spending a huge amount. My own interest in gardening evolved from, you know, the huge amount of time I spent with my dad. But that trip to Liverpool opened his eyes really to, you know, the different types of design of gardens and the range of plants. And when he was on that trip, we took the opportunity to visit quite a number of nurseries in the UK as well. And of course, that trip became the first of many then, when he, you know, discovered the availability particularly of perennial plants, and he began to order them by mail order before there was ever internet or anything like that available. And mm-hmm. The boxes came and needed a place to be planted. So you know, there was a number of catalysts like that, as such, that sparked him into developing the garden here.
Excellent. And the 4-acre garden as it is now was his vision at that time. You were saying that the front garden was getting too small for this array of plants, but was the vision always to have it as an open garden, or did that come later?
I think that probably came later. My father would always have had an interest in sharing his knowledge and enthusiasm for plants with people. So even over the years, while the garden was being developed from, you know, a field as such, people who were interested were always welcome to come and see how it was progressing. And by 10 years into its development, by the mid-90s, it became an open garden then. And it's lovely at this stage, even, 35, 36 years on, when people come back and say, oh, I was here when your father started to develop this, and they're amazed at the maturity that's come into the place and how it has evolved. And I suppose how, myself and my husband have added to it over the years since as well. It's a never ending project in lots of ways.
Yeah, lovely story, lovely history behind it there. So I didn't realize that there was going to be such a good story behind the history of it. So that's great. But as the gardens are today, could you maybe, because obviously this is a podcast, it's audio and not visual, so could you maybe set the scene and describe the garden as people would see it?
Well, when visitors arrive, they arrive at the front of our house. Sometimes people look and sort of say, sure, what can be behind that? It's a house on a rural road. There's a small gate at the side of it which leads them into the nursery or plant sales area. Most of that we redeveloped a number of years ago, and I suppose in my father's time it had quite a commercial garden centre look about it. When my father passed away in 2000, myself and my husband, we were both living and working in Dublin, and when we returned to take over the place here, we made a few rash decisions, probably some people would say, but we demolished my parents' old house and rebuilt on the same site, and we rebuilt a more characterful kind of stone house. And when you, it's like when you do up a room in the house, everything else around it then needs attention. So when we did the house, then we felt that the garden centre as such needed an overhaul, and we completely remodeled that into a more cottage garden style nursery within a garden setting. So we expanded what was the original front garden area to create a garden all around the house, first of all, in a quite a different style to what my father did with the main garden, what we refer to as the main garden. It's much more cottagey, with planting like lupins and peonies at the present time in full flower, and lots of roses and that kind of thing. So that's where people arrive, first of all, when they come to visit. And as they move through the plant sales area, then they progress down a winding sort of gravel path towards the main garden. Now, the main garden is actually at the back of our house, because in when it was originally developed, we were still in dairy farming at the time. So there was farm buildings and collection yards for cattle and all that sort of stuff, and slurry pits between the house and the main garden. And we have planted up, the root in the intervening years since, we scaled back the whole farming enterprise. We're no longer in dairying. And so it has become, from the time you arrive at the road entrance, as a journey to the garden, it's a journey through a collection of plants and landscaped areas. The site slopes away from the main road, so you're all the time descending as you move through the planted areas, and eventually arrive at a set of wooden double doors. Tall wooden doors, you can't see what's behind it. And I love watching the expression on people's faces when you open the door and they step through, not quite sure what they're expecting, and usually pleasantly surprised when they're met with just a feast, really, of colour and interest and the sounds of water and obviously the sounds of nature as well all around them. You don't see everything at once when you come into the garden. The first section of it is a semi-formal kind of gravel garden with rambling pathways through it, and these take you through beds with a whole range of different perennial plants within it, lots of shrubs and trees as well, which would have been the background structure to the garden. And then you round a corner and suddenly in front of you is the feature which we call our moon house. It's the concept came from a book on Chinese gardens that my father read, and he interpreted it Irish style into a feature that has water cascading from overhead past a circular window into a lily pond below. So there's quite a noisy feature in the garden, but at the same time, it's probably the key feature that people recognise the garden when they make a return visit as well. So that area has one character. And the next section of the garden then is more a large lawn area, and within that then there's a stream which runs through it that's bordered by perennial planting that mainly peaks in June, July and August in terms of its colour. There's lots of specimen trees within the lawn area, and further along again then there's a pond with a deck area, which is a more recent addition, something myself and my husband added about 10 years ago. in response to a flooding issue we had, which was not something I had ever experienced in the place as a child growing up, but it was a particularly wet summer. It's hard to imagine that at the present time.
Yeah.
And the garden flooded, so we had to make an emergency drainage solution to the area, and we dug a pond and we drained into that and made a deck area around it. And then beyond that again then is this moment in time, an archway with laburnum trees trained over it. That was inspired by a visit my father made to the very famous Bodmin Garden in Wales, with a much grander archway, laburnum archway like that. And there's a little gate then at the end of that, and once you open that, you're back into nature. And it takes you on a trail that's, you know, a slow walk, maybe half an hour, fast walk a little bit quicker, leads on to a lovely natural walkway by the River Nore. We're right on the banks of the River Nore. And that was planted up many years ago with all sorts of woodland, which has matured into fairly substantial trees at this stage. So it's a looped walk really along the riverbank. And it's almost like, I suppose, as you move from the roadway past our house, through the plant sales area, through the main garden, and onto the riverbank, it's a progression from formal, ornamental, back to nature, really, I suppose, as you move through the whole sense. So that's, you know, you get a sense of as much the appreciation for nature as you do for all of the ornamental planting that's in the place as well. I hope that paints a reasonable picture of it.
Yeah, that's a brilliant description of it. As I say, considering it's all audio, it is a very, very good. I can almost picture it, and I'll definitely get over in the next few weeks to have a look at it as well. But just to go back on a couple of things. So the moon house then. So that was an Irish take on a Chinese idea, and
yes.
You said that there's water cascading down into a lily pond and. Are you looking out through this round circular window?
Yes, you can go underneath it. There's a bench in there to sit on, and you can look out and listen to the water crashing above you and ponder on drops falling into the water, whatever it is takes your fancy as such. It's a great place to shelter too on a windy day. You know, you can enjoy the sights and the smells of the garden and still be cozied up, as it were, in this little kind of cavern underneath the waterfall. It's a lovely spot, as it's very much the signature feature of the garden. It's quite different. My father was an avid reader, and you know, my abiding memory of him through all the years of him developing the garden was of him going to bed every night with, you know, a book or an armful of garden magazines under his arm, and up he'd get next morning with a new idea or a new plant that he needed to source or whatever it was that he'd read about the night before. And so, you know, the book on Chinese gardens was just one that inspired all sorts of ideas that, you know, eventually materialized or in the garden itself at some stage.
Yeah, that's a good idea as well, because a bit like Master My Own Garden, and we're talking about open gardens and how they can be an inspiration. Your dad looked at the books, and it doesn't have to be an exact copy, or you don't have to replicate something as you saw it, but it's something that gives you an idea, and then, as you said, tweaked to an Irish version or to a version that suits your garden or the size of your garden.
Well, that's it. I mean, even as I mentioned there previously, the laburnum archway, which is, you know, it was inspired by, you know, a much larger feature in Bodmin, in the Bodmin Garden in Wales. This is a considerably more modest interpretation of it, and it's something that anybody could adapt in their garden, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the, you know, the laburnum that has, you know, the long chains of yellow flowers. I've seen equally attractive archways done using some malus flowering crabs on them, or indeed just ordinary apple trees, which are beautiful flower on them in the early summer, late spring, early summer, yeah. And then enjoy the apples from them after that. So, you know, the structure itself was just hollow steel bars that were bent and twisted into shape, and then there's just wires trained between them, relatively simple structure. It was actually built by my late brother. We sort of some, I suppose, sadness in our family over the years, but the garden is a great place to link us with so many people who have worked on the development of it over the years as well. And I mean, my father has passed on in 2000 at a relatively young age, at 68. And sadly, I say, I lost my brother as well back when he was in his 20s. But you never feel that they're actually gone, because there are features in the garden that, you know, are everyday reminders of them. And it's lovely to have that. And, you know, again, for, you know, people who are developing their own gardens, I think it's lovely that, you know, if you can incorporate something that reminds you of other people or times past or places you've been, whether it's through plants or plants you get from people or gifts like that. It's lovely to make those connections. I often think a garden is not just a showpiece. I tell people who visit here, our garden operates on many levels. There's a horticulture story, there's a story of the plants, there's a story of the design, but there's a whole other story as well of all of the people that I can connect with the garden. You know, in the years, in the early years, especially when my dad was developing the garden, he employed particularly a summer workers, a lot of young lads from around the place who wanted a summer job. And, you know, they came in, they worked in the place, and they come back even at this stage with their own families and their kids and say, oh, I built that, I helped plant that, or whatever they did. And, you know, it's lovely to have those connections. And so many of those young guys and girls went on to develop great businesses themselves in their own way. And oftentimes they would attribute it to my dad to say, well, we actually learned how to work with your father. He wasn't afraid of a hard graft, and they learned how to do that as well.
Yeah, that's great.
And those connections are lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. And 100% in what you're saying about connections to gardens. And I've referenced it earlier in some of the earlier episodes of the podcast where, you know, plants that are in my mother's garden have come from my grandparents' garden. And it is a really nice way of making a connection through generations. Maybe you don't appreciate it at the time, but definitely as in your situation there, as time passes on, it's a great way, a great reminder and a great way of keeping connected. Yeah, it's something that a lot of people should try and add into their garden in some way.
It is, you know, and you don't have to bring the physical plant. I mean, nowadays, you know, and especially with the huge surge in interest in gardening over the last couple of months of the whole COVID experience, you know, people are learning skills of gardening and that. And, you know, simple as, you know, dividing perennials, digging up, you know, various herbaceous perennials and dividing them in the springtime. You can share plants around or, you know, over the next couple of months, it's a great time to take cuttings of plants and perpetuate them in that way as well. So it's I think it's actually exciting time for gardening because there seems to be such a new interest in a whole new generation in the skills of gardening.
There's a lot of people who I know in, you know, in garden centres and so on, and they said that the amount of younger people, the amount of people in their 20s and 30s who are coming in now, and they're only getting started, they're only novices as such, but the fact that they're coming in and it's sparking an interest now, I suppose obviously they have time now, which they may not have had this whole COVID thing not kicked off, but it's great because not everybody will stay involved in it or will stay excited by it, but certainly there's going to be a good share of them that will, and I think that's very exciting for gardening generally.
I think it is, yeah.
As I say, you described it brilliantly, but the double doors that you open, almost like a surprise when you get to the other side of it. Were they there from the start, or was that something that was added in afterwards? It sounds like a lovely idea and something that, you know, people still don't quite know what they're going to see until they get to those doors and open them and go through.
They would have been added in towards the later stages of developing the garden. Ironically, and I can never actually explain it to people, but for some reason, my father started to develop the garden at the farthest point almost away from the house, near towards the bank of the river, which is roughly maybe about 800 or 900 yards from the house itself. And we had an old farm drain or stream that ran through the land that, you know, was originally the field that the garden is now, you know, part of. And that entered the River Nore, you know, at an extremity of the field. And short of that, I distinctly remember the day when we started to develop. It was the October bank holiday weekend of 1984. And he and I went down through, it was a fairly poorly drained, wouldn't have been the best field on the farm anyway, down towards this drain where it was entering the river. And he started to dig it out, and we made a three-tiered waterfall on it, and that followed on then later with a sort of little red wooden hut, which is a shelter, and it's still there to this day. And then he worked from there back towards the house. So actually the younger planting, the more recent development of the garden, is actually closest to the house. In the early years, and in terms of developing the structure of the garden, and it's advice I would give to anybody that's starting into a garden, my father's focus was on, you know, establishing the trees and the shrubs and what he would call the bones of the garden. You know, he put in the hedging around it, which in effect put a frame on the picture. Normally put the frame on the picture afterwards, but in the case of a garden, it's generally better to start with the frame first so that you have a backdrop on which you develop everything else, and then put in your trees and grass. And if you never went any further than that, you can have a very satisfying garden and a very easy care garden with just grass and trees.
Yeah.
And then from there on, he moved into carving out the shapes of beds, some of them taking in the farm drain that was originally here. He diverted it and moved it around and created sort of smaller ponds and pools, you know, running through the garden, really. Water is a very strong feature of the garden, not in the sense that, you know, it's very visible, but it just links some of the different spaces throughout, with the stream in particular running through.
Okay. His idea, you say you don't know what his idea was by starting at the furthest point. Listening to it, you would think that it was to use the feature of the river, which is obviously something nice, and work back from there. Would that be possibly it?
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, the river, I suppose, was a favourite place of ours, even, you know, when we walked our dogs and things like that. It was a spot we used to sit down and ponder life and all the rest. So, you know, it was always a strong feature of where we live here. It was, I suppose, natural that he would incorporate it into the garden in some way or other, albeit it is the more natural area now at this stage, and that's the right way it should be as the extremity of the garden.
Very nice. And just in terms of the garden itself now, and this is probably a tricky question, so you've mentioned lots of perennials and roses and laburnums, and if I was to ask you, out of all of them, what would your sort of three or four favourite plants be? What would they be? And, you know, how could somebody go about growing them in their own garden?
I suppose I often get asked that, and I often say it depends on the season, depends on my mood, depends on goodness knows what. But, you know, on a summer's day where we're at this stage, and, you know, with, I suppose, beautiful scents surrounding, one of my favourite shrubs to grow is the mock orange, the Philadelphus, which is in full flower at the minute with lovely double white flowers, and it's a variety called Philadelphus virginal. And it's one of the plants that's probably longest growing in the garden here, but it has the most magnificent orange blossom scent, you know, in June into July. And it's a scent that, you know, once you smell it, you never forget it. It's one of the most powerful smells that there is. It certainly is one of my favourites. But I also, you know, have an interest in particular ranges of plants. With the maturity that has come into the garden in the last few years, my focus has shifted very much towards an interest in shade-loving plants. Initially, when my father planted the garden, because it was so open, a lot of the perennial choices and shrub choices that he made favoured an open, sunny position. But now, with mature trees, mature shrubs, we have a greater requirement for shade lovers. And in particular, I love the Solomon Seal family, the Polygonatum, and its relations, Disporum and Myanthemum and plants like that. They tend to be early season plants. You know, the flowering period is more April, May, early June. Mm-hmm. But there's some very beautiful, elegant plants and lovely detail in the flowers that go with those. And many of them then have quite attractive foliage, which follows through for the rest of the season. And then I suppose for late season, an interest that I've been working on in the last few years, in effect, put my own stamp on the garden, because I've referenced my father a lot, but for the last, you know, almost 20 years, my husband and myself have been taking care of it. And we've been planting more and more hydrangeas in the garden. I suppose most people tend to concentrate on, you know, their early summer colour. And by the time you hit August, a lot of gardens are getting tired at that stage. And, the colour is beginning to fade, and the plants that blossomed early in the summer have gone over, and that's the time when hydrangeas are really getting going. Yeah. And there are so many very beautiful species hydrangeas beyond the normal pink mop heads that would be most familiar to people. We grow some like Hydrangea asperus argentiana, which has lovely large furry leaves on it, a beautiful architectural foliage plant in its own right, even if it never flowered. But in August, then, it puts on kind of lace-cap lavender-coloured flowers, and quite a large shrub. And we have it planted with Hydrangea Annabelle, which is well known for having almost football-sized, creamy-coloured flowers, lovely for cutting. and a nice one to grow. We also grow the oak leafed hydrangea, which has sort of creamy coloured flowers, I'd say shaped like a 99, that kind of look on them. Yeah. And it colours fabulously in late autumn. So my interest is in kind of, you know, something that plants that will take you through the whole season, from the likes of the Solomon's seal in the early summer to Philadelphus at this time for their wonderful fragrance, to the hydrangeas, which carries you through that into the autumn. And equally, I suppose people often underestimate just how many beautiful plants there are for winter interest. And I value winter flowering shrubs hugely as well. I think as gardeners in Ireland, we have yet to explore the whole idea of plants for winter interest. We sort of feel once, you know, September comes, it's time to turn the back on the garden and turn on the heat for the winter. But if you put the coat on, the hat and out you get, there are some beautiful plants to discover. One of my favourite winter flowering plants is suitable for even the smallest of gardens. It's called Sarcococca, commonly called the Christmas box. And it has lovely evergreen shrub with the tiniest of white flowers, but an absolutely powerful perfume. And even if you only stuck it beside, you know, the washing line when you're hanging out washing in the winter months, it's a lovely experience to have the perfume of it. So that's just a flavour of some of the things. But I mean, there's an endless amount of plants. That,
yeah, it's a difficult one to name three, but you've kind of given us a good idea there. And the fact that you've moved across the seasons in terms of flowering, again, is a nice idea. And there's some good tips there for people. If you were to give tips for people who are trying to master their own garden, be it on a small scale or a larger scale like yourself, well, you've kind of touched on it a little bit by saying what your dad had done by putting the structure in first. But what would your tips be for somebody mastering their own garden?
I think one of the key things, you know, people have their own preferences in their choices of plants and what they want to grow and all of that. But I think sometimes we tend to neglect our soil a lot. And if it was the one tip I was to give, it is really to nurture your soil. And I would say even ourselves, you know, both myself and my husband are qualified gardeners, but sometimes we get too busy to do things right. And it is coming back to bite us in the last few years, in the sense that my late father used to not dig deep, but every spring he would cultivate the surface of the soil to open it up as such after the winter, to let air into it, which of course encourages all the earthworms and all the good creatures that live underground, but also opens it up so that moisture can get into it. And he would have mulched it fairly regularly with good organic matter. In our case, at that time, it was farmyard manure. But in recent years, this time of the year, this early part of the summer, April, May and June, has become so dry now. And it's repeated over the last 5 or 6 years. It looks like it's going to be the pattern for the future. I think people need to pay more attention to incorporating organic matter, you know, compost material and that into their soils. And what that does for your soil is it helps it to hold moisture. It helps it to hold nutrients. And so you end up with much healthier and better performance from your plants. You know, I used to teach years ago in the botanic gardens in Glasnevin, and even through my own years in college when I was in UCD, I always found the subject of soil science absolutely fascinating. And you know, I think, you know, that there's merit in looking after your soil, then the rest happens itself after that.
That's a great tip. And I actually had 2 weeks ago, I had Dr. Brian Murphy on. He's a soil scientist with Enrich Environmental, and it was all about the topic of organic matter. And that was, you know, he was obviously talking about the benefits of it, but it is a point that gets overlooked, not just by gardeners, but in general it gets overlooked, particularly, you know, where these gardens are being set up and laid out by builders in sites and so on. And yeah, and even in existing gardens, maybe the mulching part of it that used to be commonplace years ago is not as common
well,
now.
It is. And as you say, so many people inherit gardens, whether they're small gardens in a semi-D, three-bed semi-D, or whether they're larger scale sites, you know, that have been worked over through building construction one way or another. And often the soil has been degraded or is in fairly poor condition. But with a little bit of work, you can turn it into you know, good productive soil, it doesn't necessarily require you to spend a lot of money or a lot of hardship in some ways of bringing in topsoil. You can work with what you have. You know, I spent many years working in a Dublin local authority as well, and my job involved street tree management. And people had a huge intolerance to, you know, leaf fall on street pavements in the autumn. And I used to think I would love to bring home all of the leaves in Dublin for compost here. I mean, they refer to leaves as gardener's gold, and that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
You know, if people gather their leaves in autumn and make compost from it, it is absolutely the best compost you can have. And that's what we use mostly ourselves here now. It's a combination really of leaf mold compost and horse manure. Which is great for conditioning the soil, and I say particularly good and valuable at this time when, you know, the soil conditions are so dry, for holding any little bit of moisture that falls and in turn passing it on to your plants.
Yeah, no, it's hugely important. And two episodes ago, I had one on conserving water, and mulching was I think one of the main points in that, because it is so vital. And as you rightly said, we're in the middle of a hose pipe ban as of today. And
that's right.
I think that's the third, maybe, or fourth hosepipe ban over the last few years. So it is becoming a regular feature, and it doesn't necessarily always come at the same time. It's quite a bit earlier this year than in previous years, but it is a common feature. So it's something we should definitely be trying to, you know, figure out a way, whether that's mulching or conserving water or harvesting our own water, of being able to adapt to this situation, because it is becoming commonplace, really.
That's true.
Just to go back a little bit, you mentioned, and we didn't speak about it too much, was your plant sales area. So your plant sales area, you said it looked originally like, you know, a conventional garden centre as such, and you've changed it now. So maybe describe it now, and what exactly are you doing in terms of plant sales? Is it all plants that are cultivated from the garden, or is it, you know, a replica of what is in the garden, or how is the plant sales area operated?
Well, I mean, as I said, it was originally quite a commercial garden centre, and we stocked all things that everybody could want, from summer bedding to perennials to roses to hedging to fruit trees to all the normal stuff you expect to find. But in the last few years, or the last 10 years or so, my husband and I, we scaled it back to a much smaller range of plants, but slightly different to what you get in the more conventional garden centres. And we do propagate mostly from our own garden. Particularly, most of the perennial plants that we stock come from the garden, and they tend to be a little bit different. Different years I propagate different things depending on how much I have available in the garden. You know, we tend to stock quite a range of hardy geraniums, which our feature of the garden here. We've over 40 different varieties in them, and you know, I appreciate them, my father appreciated them as great garden plants, because you know, they'll tolerate all sorts of situations that you throw at them, whether it's wet, dry, sun, shade. There's a hardy geranium for it, and so many of them flower for a long period. But we have a huge range of perennials. We also stock a lot of more unusual shrubs. You know, again, a feature of the garden are some of the flowering dogwoods like Cornus cusa, Cornus teutonia, plants like that, which are come into flower in the next few weeks with lovely creamy white bracts on them, and then later on in the year they have strawberry like fruits on them. We stock a very small range of roses, some that I buy, some of the old-fashioned types that we propagate ourselves. And it is mainly roses that you can see growing here in the garden that are tried and tested. So you won't find the full range, but you'll find ones that we like ourselves. That's probably not a great business proposition to grow just stuff you like yourself. But it also means, I suppose, that from myself and my husband Ross, our point of view, we can, you know, we share our knowledge with our customers with our own experience of growing the plants. So, you know, it's gardeners coming to talk to gardeners. And they get the full whack of our benefit of our own experience of growing them. And I'd say that's our main focus. It's not a huge range. It changes all the time over the summer, from year to year, depending on what we get to propagate. We do specialise, I suppose, because I'm in my hydrangea phase of life, we have quite a range of those as well. So it's an eclectic range, I'll say, of gardeners' plants as such. And that's not to say that it's exclusive in any way to, you know, people who are starting out. It's just that we offer something that's a little bit different. So we're not competing We're not competing with anybody else. You know, people can come and see the things growing in our own garden and decide whether they like them or not, and they'll see how they grow, the size they'll achieve, and the conditions they like.
Yeah, I think that's a lovely idea that you're not doing exactly what all the mainstream places are doing yet. It's something a little bit different, and the fact that you can see them in the garden is good. You've mentioned a
Well, it
couple
also.
of, sorry, you've
Sorry.
mentioned a
Yep.
couple of really nice plants there. Hardy geraniums are very
Yeah.
underrated, I think, because as you said, they've a very long flowering period, and with a couple of the varieties, you can get flower from pretty much April until October, which
Well,
is
that's
a
right. I
very
mean,
long flowering period, and
you
as
know,
I
the
said,
plant of
they're
the century was Geranium Roseanne. It was voted that at Chelsea Flower Show a few years ago. It's a lovely, low-growing, blue-flowered one, and it's quite a compact grower. But it starts to flower now in June, and it still flowers till October. And it has a sister plant that we grow called Lilac Ice, which has slightly golden-tinted foliage and a paler kind of pale lavender-coloured flower with sort of red veins in it. And it's a lovely one too, but tremendous for flower power. And then, you know, in certain parts of our own garden here, we have areas under trees which are extremely dry. And anybody who tries to choose plants for dry shade is often left scratching their head as to what's going to survive with that. And there's an early season geranium, Geranium macrorhizum, a particularly nice one called Bevan's variety, which has a lovely cerise flower on it. And then later on in the summer, it has good, nice autumn colouring and the leaves turn lovely and red. But it tolerates dry shade like no other plant I have seen. Wonderful for it and takes all that sort of difficult conditions. So it's, you know, amongst them there's extremes. As I say, they take wet, they take dry, they take sun and shade and all else in between.
Yeah, a super plant. And just before we kind of finish off or round off, the roses, you say you grow a small range of tried and trusted older varieties. What, just name one or two of them there that you would grow?
One of my favourites is Buff Beauty. You know, many of the old-fashioned roses tend to be in shades of pinks and crimsons and whites and mauves. And Buff Beauty is slightly unusual in that the flowers are a lovely apricot yellow colour, and it has the most gorgeous fruity scent to it. And that's one of the real reasons I love growing the old-fashioned roses, because unlike so many of the modern floribundas and hybrid teas nowadays, they have fantastic scent, and many of them are repeat flowering too and will carry on through the summer season. So that's one of my favorites. And another one we grow is quite a tall growing variety called Ispahan. It's a sort of a pink rich pink coloring, and again a lovely powerful perfume from it. And it's something that you can grow as a shrub in a mixed border. It doesn't need to be set, you know, like some of the more rigid type roses, I'll call them, like the floribundas and hybrides, in a bed on their own. It fits in equally well with other shrubs and with perennials and whatever. And then I suppose we do grow some of the more modern roses, and in particular a lovely variety we grow is called Champagne Moment. It is one I came across when I was looking for a gift for a friend who had gotten engaged, and I bought a couple of plants for her and thought they were wonderful in her garden. So I thought, well, I'll have some of those. So and I planted a bed of them, but I haven't planted them in traditional way people would plant floribunda roses. We've mixed them in with Alcamilla, the lady's mantle, growing around the base, because I hate the bare stems of so many of those you know, bush roses like
Yeah.
that. And I've also planted them with alliums, which are wonderful natural deterrent of all the problems and pests and issues that you have with roses. That's a whole other story in its own right then, with companion planting. But alliums make great partners to roses for deterring your green fly and your mildews and your black spots.
Oh, brilliant. And you've actually started a conversation there that we might have to have again about companion planting. But no, that's brilliantly described there, and some lovely choices of plants. We've actually got on quite a bit longer than we had planned,
I've
and
realised that.
yeah, you've done a fantastic job of describing the garden. I can almost, as I said earlier, I can almost picture it now before I get there, but I will get there in the next couple of weeks. Just before we finish off, where can people find you, and where can people find Gash Gardens? And maybe tell us a little bit about, obviously, your opening hours, and is there anything changed with the COVID conditions and so on? So maybe just direct people to where
Okay.
they can find you.
Well, we're just about 1/2 mile from the village of Castletown in Laois. That's about 10 miles roughly from Port Laois, which is probably best well known to most people. We open from the garden is open from the 1st of May ordinarily. We got to open on the 18th of May this year with the COVID restrictions, and it's open until the end of September, to the 30th of September. We open Monday to Saturday from 10 o'clock until 5 o'clock every day. We don't open on Sundays. We keep that for family. We have young family, and that's our day for that. And we welcome visitors anytime from Monday to Saturday, so during our opening hours. We also welcome, you know, groups. Normally at this time of the year, we get a lot of visiting groups, whether they're garden groups or active retireds or ICAs or men's sheds and all other groups such as that as well. This year, that's obviously not possible for most groups to travel, but we'd hope in future years that we can return to welcoming groups as well. But certainly individuals are most welcome. We've been enjoying quite a new interest, I suppose, from the local people in the last few weeks since we reopened. And hopefully as the restrictions ease, people will be able to come to visit us from a little further afield. We do have a website. It's gashgardens.ie. It's a website that's due an overhaul, and that's planned over the next couple of months. But probably for more up-to-date information, if people care to follow us at Gash Gardens on Facebook. I do fairly regular posts of what's happening in the garden on that, and give people an insight into what's happening and what's of interest.
Excellent. Yeah, that's really, really exciting. And as I said, this is the first of this type of a podcast that I've done, and I'm planning to do roughly one a month over the next year. So it's great to have Gash Gardens, who's from my fellow county Laois, on as the first guest. So Mary, thank you very much. It was a super chat, and there was some brilliant information there, and lots of tips that people can take into their own garden. So as I say, much appreciated, and very, very big thanks to you for coming on.
Well, John, thank you very much, and we look forward to welcoming you soon to visit us. So
that's been this week's episode. A huge thanks to Mary for coming on. Gash Garden sounds like a really interesting place, and the story behind it, the origins of the garden. Her dad sounds like he was a really innovative guy and ahead of his time, really, in terms of gardening. And as I said, to know that it's in my own county, it's definitely somewhere I'm going to get over to in the coming weeks. And when I do, I'll report back and let you know what I think of it all. But from Mary's description, it sounds like a fantastic garden, fantastic place, somewhere you'll get lots of inspiration. And Mary herself was brilliant in the interview, extremely knowledgeable, and explained the gardens and described the gardens very, very well. So huge thanks to Mary for coming on. That's been this week's episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with all your gardening friends. You can find me on the social channels, which is John Jones at Master My Garden, and Instagram at Master My Garden. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in future episodes, just let me know. That's been this week's episode, and until the next time, happy gardening.